Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner Dia versus the Bronx.
May it please the court, Mr. James B. Lewis will present argument to petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
The court is hearing the the motion to dismiss, the procedural question along with the substance of this case. I would appreciate it if you'd start off on the procedural matter and then move to the Rule 11 issue.
May it please the court, counsel, justices. I'm Jim Lewis, representing Enrique Padilla in this appeal from a lawsuit to enforce a written, signed, and filed settlement agreement. Opposing counsel has filed a motion to dismiss, as they did in the Court of Appeals, claiming that the transcript was untimely filed, and also claiming that there was no motion for a new trial or its equivalent filed that extended the appellate timetable for filing the transcript. I have filed a response, which is petitioner's response to respondent's letter motion to dismiss, and reply to the response to the application for writ of error, which addresses all of those points. In substance, a motion for reconsideration was filed, which would have changed the judgment, and which did address the judgment which was subsequently signed. Although prematurely filed, this certainly operates, as would a motion for new trial, to extend the appellate timetable, as many cases cited in the briefs suggest. Now, regarding the other matter, there is only one single issue presented in this case. But this court's decision will have far-reaching impact on modern trial practice, Texas jurisprudence, and the perceived integrity of the legal profession. The single issue presented to this court is whether a written, signed settlement agreement, to be enforceable, must be filed before consent to it is withdrawn. That is, whether a party must race to the courthouse to file the written, signed agreement before the other party decides to repudiate. The respondents have never stated any policy reason why a written agreement, to be enforceable, must be filed before consent to it is withdrawn. In fact, if the agreement is in writing and signed by the parties to be bound, there is no reason to require a race to the courthouse to make sure the document is filed before one party repudiates. There are at least three good policy reasons why there should be no such requirement. First, modern trial practice involves informal agreements between counsel, which are then memorialized by letters between counsel. And a party obtains a peace of mind when that agreement is in writing and signed.
I need to be clear. Are you arguing that Rule 11 doesn't require agreement at the time the agreement is filed with court, or are you arguing that it is immaterial in a contract context that the agreement was in connection with a lawsuit? I'm not clear what you're arguing about the necessity of filing the agreement. Are you taking the position that this was a Rule 11 agreement and it's immaterial that the consent was withdrawn before it was filed with court? Are you arguing that filing with court doesn't make this contract otherwise an enforceable contract?
Your Honor, I am saying that Rule 11 does apply and that the filing requirement does apply, but that there is no reason that it must be filed before consent to it is withdrawn. Because the reason behind the Rule 11 agreement is because oral agreements often result in controversy because of memory, because of the fallibility of the human memory, as Justice Gonzalez wrote in his dissent in Kennedy v. Hyde.
Then what is the significance of Rule 11's, what benefit do the parties get who want to enforce a Rule 11 agreement? What's the benefit they obtain?
The benefits they obtain, I know the purpose, if you're asking the purpose of the filing requirement of Rule 11, the purpose that I see for the filing requirement of Rule 11 is so that the court has access to the written, signed document, so that the court can make sure that its terms are certain and clear, as in this case. This was a settlement for the full policy limits in settlement of all claims. Very simple agreement. It was in writing and it was signed. but it just was not filed before contested was withdrawn. Once there became a dispute, then it was filed, and the court had access to that document.
Then what is the significance of, well, if the rule says to be enforceable, it must be filed with the court, your argument is that any time you have an agreement with counsel, if it's in writing, there's no necessity of having it filed with the court for enforcement. It's simply a perfunctory precondition to court enforcement of the order. The filing is just simply a perfunctory sort of deal you do, kind of notifying, I'm going to intend to enforce this.
Yes, in essence, I'm saying that in order that the court has access to the written, signed document, that is the purpose of the filing requirement. And in fact, the filing requirement would be a real impediment to modern settlement practices and even mediation settlement practices, because often parties require as a term of the settlement that the agreement remain confidential, that the terms of the agreement are confidential. This could never be achieved if a party had to race to the courthouse before the other party had an opportunity to repudiate, because then it would become a public record. And we all know the problems with Rule 76A, sealing of court records. It is a very difficult process, and it takes time. And a party would always have a chance to enter into a written signed agreement, even at mediation, since mediation still concerns pending litigation. It is not taking it out of the court system as a binding arbitration is. Mediation, I do not understand the rulings of the Ames and Banks cases, because I believe that Rule 11 would apply equally even to mediation agreements, because those are agreements touching pending litigation, just as any other Rule 11 agreement is. And many times, parties want to keep the terms of the agreement confidential, and there's no way they could do that if they were required to immediately race to the courthouse and file that document before the other party had an opportunity to repudiate. Now, there are several other reasons I have addressed. The first two reasons why the filing requirement before consensus is withdrawn should not be imposed, and those are the modern trial practice concerns and the confidentiality concerns. And the third is Texas has a longstanding policy of preferring settlement to litigation. Here, the LaFrances not only want to continue with the present litigation, but they wish to subsequently pursue bad faith litigation against Padilla's insurer. All of the same concerns here exist when it is a mediation settlement agreement. There's absolutely nothing in Rule 154 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code that removes this from the requirements of Rule 11. It merely states that it can be enforced as any other contract. Well, so can a settlement agreement, as long as it meets the requirements of Rule 11. Here, our settlement agreement does meet the requirements of Rule 11. It was in writing, it was signed by the party to be bound, and it was filed with the court.
Is it your position that this agreement cannot be enforced as a contract but for the fact that it's filed with the court under Rule 11?
Yes, I believe it must comply with Rule 11, because it is an agreement concerning pending litigation, as would a mediation agreement be, as would any other settlement agreement be. But the only reason for the filing requirement is so that the court has access to the document, and so that can make the agreement clear and certain. There's nothing about the filing requirement itself, a filing requirement that makes the agreement any more certain or clear. It merely gives the court access to the document. Now, there are three issues which should be addressed here, which are not involved in this lawsuit, but which are important to distinguish, because the respondents have attempted to interject them into this case in order to avoid the issue presented. First, this case involves Padilla's lawsuit with pleadings and proof to enforce a written, signed settlement agreement which was filed with the court. It does not involve an attempt to enter a consent judgment without consent. The respondents rely entirely on cases such as Samples and Buffalo Bag, which involve attempts to enter consent judgments without consent.
Accepting that argument as true, what relief are you entitled to by suing to enforce a settlement agreement? Wouldn't it be the same relief as if this were a consent judgment?
It would be the same relief that is enforcement of the agreement. The difference is here we have brought pleadings and proof to prove the terms of the agreement. in the case of a consent judgment, there is no requirement that there be pleadings and proof because consent exists at the time the judgment is entered. Now, counsel for respondents has asserted that Rule 11 applies equally to consent judgments as it does to settlement agreements. But Rule 11 really has no application with consent judgments at all, because even if you have a Rule 11 agreement, it doesn't make any difference if consent does not exist at the time the judgment is entered. But a Rule 11 agreement is evidence for the enforcement of the written, signed settlement agreement as long as pleadings and proof are brought. Here, pleadings and proof were brought in the motion for summary judgment. All of the pertinent documents were attached, and I've also attached the documents as appendices to the briefs. So we are suing for enforcement of a written, signed settlement agreement. We are not attempting to gain entry of a consent judgment without consent.
In that connection, let me just make sure procedurally I understand. The trial court granted LaFrance's motion for summary judgment, and that was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. You are you contending there's merely a fact issue that ought to, by which we ought to reverse Court of Appeals judgment and remand it for a factual determination as to whether a contract did in fact exist?
That's an alternative position, Your Honor, because the court in fact ruled that as a matter of law, the contract elements of offer and acceptance existed. The court put that right in the judgment, that the contract elements of offer and acceptance existed as a matter of law. I believe this court can render judgment based upon the documents presented in the motion for summary judgment, because as the Alice Formalware case said, that when considering the granting of one party's motion for summary judgment, the court can at the same time consider the other party's denial of summary judgment.
So you're asking for rendition in your favor, alternatively for remand?
Yes, Your Honor.
In dealing with facts a little bit, on the formation of the contract issue, as I understand it, the offer required performance or acceptance. What evidence and subsequent to the entry of that offer, you could have some oral modifications of it. What evidence is there in the record that the party extending the offer agreed to accept an oral acceptance as opposed to performance? If that's not in the record, what evidence is there in the record that the offer was accepted by performance?
Your Honor, the acceptance was actually made by the LaFrance's counsel. There was an offer on April 10th, 1991, by the LaFrance's counsel to settle, which had that time of performance requirement in it. There was a counteroffer, and the judge of the trial court ruled that it was a counteroffer on April 23rd, where it stated that we agreed to meet the policy limit demands. Not the time of performance demands, but the policy limit demands, that the only thing holding up this case is the medical lien. The medical lien was a material term because that affected the price of settlement. That is, they would have had to pay in excess of the policy limits if that term had not been addressed, and it had not been addressed in the April 10th letter. Then counsel for the LaFrances, on the very day that they claim the performance was due, April 23rd, 1991, late in the afternoon, faxed over a letter which stated, "Dear Mr. Bradshaw, this letter will confirm that the above referenced matter has been settled for all applicable policy limits, which have been represented to us to be $40,000. Please forward settlement checks in the above referenced matter. This office will agree to take care of the lien filed by the Medical Center Hospital out of the settlement funds forwarded by your office." That is the acceptance letter, the acceptance of the offer by Padilla, the counteroffer. Padilla had tendered the policy limits 4 months earlier, back in December of 1990. If they are now claiming that it was a material term, the time of performance, they could have accepted at least 4 months earlier, but they were pursuing other claims against the manufacturer of the automobile and the hospital, which they have now settled. Now they see an opportunity for gain. And that's exactly what they're pursuing here, is a bad faith claim against Padilla's insurer, or that's what they're attempting to achieve.
If Padilla was attempting to get out of this and was offering the policy limits, why did they not offer the check on the date it was due for the policy limits?
Because the medical lien issue had not yet been addressed. They addressed that after the April 10th, 1991 demand letter. They addressed that and then a letter indicating that it had not yet been addressed on April 23rd was back to counsel for the LaFrances. And they finally agreed, yeah, we'll take care of the medical lien. Now that issue is resolved, and this case is settled. The acceptance letter is contained at tab 3 of the application.
Okay, for your position, to come to your position, it is not that you accepted the LaFrances' offer. Your position is that we did not accept their offer, we rejected their offer, but we substituted an offer which they accepted.
Yes, Your Honor, it's not only my position, but it was the position of Judge Wood, as indicated at tab, I believe, 6 of the application for of error. She ruled that there was an offer, a counteroffer, and an acceptance by the LaFrances Council.
How would that necessarily preclude a bad faith lawsuit, if you're right?
Because we did accept it, and if there wasn't, there was no longer contained in this acceptance letter or in our counteroffer letter, there wasn't a term for time of performance. And
well, you can settle the underlying insurance claim without settling the bad faith claim, can't you?
My time is up, Your
Honor. I think you can answer.
I'm not understanding your question. We're trying to gain enforcement of the settlement agreement. They are claiming that there was no settlement agreement at all.
Right, but you can settle part of the claim without, in other words, you can settle the contractual or the liability claim without settling the bad faith claim, can't you?
Well, there wasn't a bad faith. They were trying to create a bad faith claim.
There wasn't a bad faith claim at that time.
Presently exists.
But yeah. Even if you had settled, even if you're right and this is an enforceable agreement, what is there to bar a subsequent bad faith claim?
Well, it's extinguished because then the settlement has occurred. I'm talking about a Stowers claim that they failed to reasonably settle within the time limits prescribed. And in fact, we did settle within the time limit prescribed. We settled, the agreement was April 23rd, 1991, and we tendered payment within 1 week, certainly within a reasonable period of time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. D. Craig Olivier will present argument for respondents.
Would counsel, would you also start on the procedural issues and whether or not the rule on motion for new trial can be reasonably extended to motion to reconsider a summary judgment?
And please, this honorable court, it's a privilege to appear on behalf of the surviving members of the LaFrance family, and personally, it's a heck of a way, although a bit nerve-wracking to start the new year. The transcript issue, basically I want to say two things on the transcript issue. Our position is that the motion for reconsideration, if you look at it and analyze the context of all the filings, it wasn't really a bona fide attempt to extend the appellate time tag. The reason I say that is first, if everybody agrees, you can't be bound by the label. You need to look at the guts of what it's asking for. All it's asking for is a motion for summary judgment. And 10 days after it was filed, the timetable is we had our hearing. Cross motions are filed. We have our hearing. We have a docket entry. But we don't have an order. They then file a motion for reconsideration. 10 days later, they file yet another motion for summary judgment. They have it set for hearing. That hearing never happened. It was passed. Then months later, it's 4 months later, the drafting stage, the order is completed and the court actually enters an order. We say that if you analyze the guts of the motion, it doesn't constitute a bona fide attempt to extend the appellate timetable. It certainly doesn't within the context of the procedure. If that was really an attempt to extend the timetable, why are they filing another motion for summary judgment? After the appellate process was started, they filed a motion to accelerate the appeal.
Well, if it's during the court still has plenary jurisdiction, then there's nothing inconsistent about filing another motion, is there? The motion for summary judgment?
Only to the extent there's some case law that says if you file a second motion, the first motion is moot or something like that. In essence, the substantive difference between the first and second motion was they argued section 154.071 of the Texas Civil Practices and Maintenance Code, which is a new argument. And it involves mediation and alternative dispute resolution, and the legislature has specifically accepted from the parameters of Rule 11 mediation agreements in that section. And we think that's significant. He's talking about the confidentiality of mediation agreements and what have you. The reason that some of these, I believe, lower courts are extending the enforceability to mediation and ADR process is by virtue of the legislative enactment. But notwithstanding that, that's our position in a nutshell, Shell, that neither the context of the, or the thrust of the motion or its timing suggests a bona fide attempt to extend.
Well, motion, do you concede that had the trial court signed the judgment and then counsel had filed within 30 days a motion to reconsider and called it that, that would be a motion for new trial? Or should be treated as a motion for new trial?
The problem that we have with that, I can't concede that, although the law may be hurting on this, but there's a line of cases that talks about whether a J&OV motion equals a motion for new trial for purposes of extending the time. Frankly, I think the most recent authority says that if the relief requested would purport to change the ruling, that that will be treated as a motion for new trial. I suppose that had none of this other circumstantial events occurred, that our position would be a lot shakier.
Well, putting putting that together with the rule that says prematurely filed motions will be considered as filed on the date at which the judgment's signed, why doesn't that extend the appellate time limit here?
You know, in those circumstances, I think it probably would.
It probably would. And thank you very much. In what circumstance?
In the circumstance where you don't have additional motions filed, in the circumstance of a 4 to 6, I think it's a 4 month delay with the filing of subsequent motions after the motion for reconsideration before the order. And the reason for that is because you can't tell by the timing what order they're directing their motion to. You can't tell if the motion is live. And you can't extrapolate an intent to invoke the appellate process because of it.
If we call everything a motion for new trial and go back to all previous motions, then just always search the file to find some motion to reconsider.
I think if they file a motion for new trial, they call it that, they ask for a new trial, and our position is not strong.
Now on the moving,
that's the end
of that procedural question. Moving to the Rule 11 issue, are you claiming $2 million of damages because of this week, that it took a week to mail the check?
Your Honor, we're not there yet. That's about three steps in front of where we are in this case. No such claim has been made in the experience.
But you have made a bad faith claim.
After the summary judgment, we sent a settlement for settlement purposes.
You what?
We sent a settlement demand for settlement purposes after the summary judgment was granted and confirmed. I think it was either before or after the court.
And how much was that for?
It was over $2 million.
And what? I'm just curious as to what the facts are.
The facts are that Michelle of France was a courtroom bailiff for Lynn Hughes.
Well, not those facts that far back. But what did the insurance company do that was bad faith in terms of the handling of this case, according to your allegation?
Because we haven't alleged.
You haven't alleged anything yet. You just made a demand.
That's right.
What was the basis for the $2 million demand?
Well, the basis would have been that a time demand deadline was made that was not complied with, thereby subjecting the insured to excess exposure. And of course, that hadn't happened yet because there hasn't been a trial on the underlying court. There's a 2040 policy. And one thing I want, before I lose any time here, or out of time, we do not agree that there was agreement to settle this case after 5 p.m. on April 23, 1991.
Well, apparently, despite, if I recall the facts correctly, despite opposing counsel's argument that they made a counteroffer which nullified that time demand, they called on the 30th asking for an extension of time, so they apparently assumed it was still binding.
Well,
is that correct?
I agree, Judge, and the timing is, we just have two different versions about what happened, and the court is restricted by the record, and unfortunately there's nothing else but the record, because the only, here,
the Judge Woods' findings have any effect at this point?
Judge, we cannot appeal from a wherefore statement in an order which in which the order ultimately grants us our relief. We view the wherefore statements as something that is not the decretal portion of the order, and that does not grant or take away from error. The guts of her order involved whether there was a rule of agreement. I think that's clear. If I could very briefly go through this, there's an April 10 time demand deadline. Now remember, there's a 2040 policy, $20,000 per person. One of the persons involved is a brain-damaged attorney. One of the persons involved in the car is her mother, who is killed. The other person in the car is her father, who has personal injuries and has bystander claims. In the April 10 letter, there are two separate policy limit demands. $20,000 for Michelle, who has through her guardian, who is the brain-damaged attorney. $20,000 for her dead mother, her estate, and her father's personal injury and bystander claims grouped in one. There's a third policy limit demand in that letter, that it be paid within a time limit. Now, in the summary judgment record, there are no phone conversations between the author of that letter and the defense attorney at any time during the operative period of time. There are no phone conversations between the author of that letter and the insurance adjuster at any time during the operative period of time. There is no summary judgment evidence of any subjective intent on the part of the author of the letter or on the part of the insurance adjuster that the time limit be extended. None. Not one whit of summary judgment evidence on that. The only question that the insurance adjuster had is in this, it's in the transcript at page 135, it's his fax response early on the day of the 23rd, which is the deadline. This will confirm our settlement agreement of 4-1891, when he apparently called and talked to the author's secretary, whereby State Farm agreed to meet the policy limit demands set out in your letter of April 10, 1991. Now, there's no exception to that. What are the demands set out in the April 10 letter? You pay $20,000 for the decedent and her husband and the bystander claims. You pay $20,000 for Michelle. We agree to meet these demands. Third demand, pay it within a timeline. We agree to meet these demands. The only thing holding up resolution of this is the hospital lien. The hospital lien only pertains to Michelle's case. It does not affect one iota the $20,000 policy limit demand over here for the decedent, her estate, and her husband and his bystander claim.
Is it your view that the Stowers' duty requires payment within a certain period of time?
Within a reasonable time, depending upon the facts and circumstances. And that's not an issue at this point. But
why was the time of the essence here?
The time is of the essence? Well, it's not a record. I can tell you some of the reasons, but...
Well, I mean, was there an upcoming trial setting? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, Mr. Olivier, go ahead. Answer the question.
Now, this is either an acceptance of our time limit demand, or it's an acceptance of the time limit with one modification. On Michelle, what about the lien? Okay? The return fax, which is sent to them 30 minutes before 5 o'clock, says, we'll take care of the lien. Now, we view this as an acceptance of the, we view it on its face. We agree to meet the policy limit demands set out in your letter of April 10, 1991. Now, as to the decedent and her husband, when they failed to tender that check by 5 p.m. on the 23rd, they had repudiated their acceptance. As to Michelle, after we sent the letter saying we take care of her, it is our position that failing to tender that check by 5 p.m. would be the date of the agreement. The whole process in this argument is, in our view, confused because we are the bad guys. We have reneged on an agreement. There is no intent. There is no intention at all, at any time, from our side of the position, that there be an agreement to settle this case after 5 p.m.
Why shouldn't this case go back for a hearing, a factual evidentiary hearing, to determine whether these various pieces of paper and the conversations that went back and forth represented an enforceable agreement under Rule 11?
Judge, I don't think it is. I think that as a matter, I think what Rule 11 needs to be, and this is my own view, is Rule 11 needs to be a rule in which the court determines yes or no. And the policy behind that is so that we don't have, here we have a products liability suit, a medical malpractice suit, a car wreck, and then all of a sudden we've got a claim about a settlement. And it's our view that even given the best case scenario from that side of the table, there's questions about it. Given our view, there's no question. But you're suddenly spawning litigation within litigation. We think that's bad.
Well, if there's a dispute about whether multiple communications actually constitute an enforceable agreement, is there any alternative other than the trial judge either granting summary judgment for the plaintiff or for the defendant?
We think Rule 11 says that if there's a dispute, there is no agreement.
Where does it say that?
It says that in, well, I say that it says that in the rule and in the policy behind it, because the way I read the rule is if there's not an agreement at the time that the transaction is filed with the court, there's not an agreement. It says no agreement will be enforced unless it be in writing, signed, and filed. It is our position that if it's not, if there's not consensuality at the time it's filed, it's not an agreement.
Is there any case that supports that?
I think that all of the consent judgment cases support that view, as does Kennedy versus Hyde.
Are any of the others a written agreement where this, the others, these briefs represented were oral agreements, which do have another layer of problem.
Well, they do, except that many of those oral agreement cases were oral agreements made in court, which is part of what the Rule 11 contemplates. It's not only a written agreement, but a Rule 11 agreement is also an agreement made in open court and entered of record. And in the Kennedy case, I know that Justice Gonzalez had concerns in the dissent because there was no dispute. The man agreed, and the deposition testimony was that he agreed. And in the dissent, it says that this is not a suit to construe language of an unclear agreement or one in which the court would be forced to supply absent terms. In our case, there is no agreement.
Even if there had been those, say this had all been written out and the time deadline was stated in a written agreement, one could still argue that the time was not of the essence and that part of the agreement could not vitiate, failure to comply with that could not vitiate the rest.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think that the offeror is, in a long line of cases, is that the offeror has the power to construct.
Well, there's no question about that, but there is contract law that says sometimes time provisions are material and sometimes they're not. And you could raise that issue, whether or not successfully, even if the agreement was put in writing and signed and notarized and filed with the court. How does that filing process remove the same quarrels about what does our agreement mean just because it's filed?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but
you can still argue about what the agreement means, even if it's filed with the court.
That's right. And what I think in the perfect world, what Rule 11 ought to be, is even if it's filed with the court, if it's not clear and unequivocal, if it doesn't have all the material terms spelled out, so that if there, you know, there is a dispute when the court or the tribunal has got to rule on it, if there is a dispute, I think Rule 11 is constructed so that it can't be enforced. Now, if there's an intellectual problem about when consent should exist, because there are different types of Rule 11 agreements. If there's a stipulation, I attached in the transcript at page 142, I had copies of this. This is a Rule 11 agreement. It looks like one, walks like one, talks like one. It was drafted by petitioner's counsel during the pendency of this case. This is what a Rule 11 agreement looks like. It's dealing with a stipulation about a hearing.
I have a question about something.
Yeah.
Did you make a statement in your argument a couple days ago that the April 23rd letter from your partner to Mr. Bradshaw was faxed 10 minutes to 5 on the 23rd?
I believe it was faxed before.
By your partner to Mr. Bradshaw?
Yes.
And is that reflected in the record? Are those facts reflected in the record?
I believe it is. I want to point it out to you at the moment that I will.
I just want to make sure I understand.
Home and do that.
Fast about that letter.
Yeah, I think it's in the summary judgment affidavit, but it clearly occurred before the deadline.
Now, why does that letter at 4:30 p.m. not show us, as a matter of law, that time was not of the essence and was not part of the agreement?
I don't think it speaks to the question of time of the essence. What that letter is a letter in a series of writings. It needs to be construed within the series of writings. And it has to especially be construed in the context of the letters responding. The case law is clear that where several instruments are executed contemporaneously or at different times that pertain to the transaction, they will be read together, although they do not expressly refer to each other according to this court's opinion. The 1951 Board of Insurance Commissioners at 239 Southwestern 2nd, 803 at page 809. It has to be read in context. All that letter is saying is, we will take care of the lien. He's agreed to, and the record is not clear when his facts came, but it came earlier in that day. In the 10 years since Kennedy versus Hyde, I remember in 1984, I didn't have a fax machine. And today, unfortunately, the faxes are so prevalent that we had to instill rules about them. We respectfully pray this court affirm the courts below. There was never any agreement.
The missing element was a time of occupancy. It was critical to your...
That's what we say. It was part of our offer.
Part and parcel of they didn't, and there was no...
They repudiated it, and they didn't do it.
And you understand, in the demand letter of the 10th, emphasized that the deadline was 5 p.m. on the 23rd and stated specifically that no oral conversation or agreement between the parties could alter that. They agreed to comply with your demand letter, discuss the outstanding lien early on the 23rd, later on the 23rd, but before the deadline. You responded with a fax letter saying, we accept and we'll take care of the lien. They claim not to have seen that letter until the next day, the 24th. But they didn't even bother to try to contact you until the 30th. And then they asked for an extension of time, an extension of the deadline on the 23rd. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. Except and we say on the 30th they made a new offer. We talked the language, it's in the affidavit, and we said no. But that's it in a nutshell. And that reinforces the fact that as of 5 p.m. on the 23rd, no one had any good faith belief that there had been any extension of time granted because the summary judgment evidence, uncontroverted, is that the
there's no further communication for a full week until the 30th, correct?
That's right, and not only that, but the recipient of our Stanley's 23rd fax didn't even see it till the next day. So he left the office without any belief or intention that there had been any extension of time with respect to Michelle's case, and certainly there was no discussion about the other $20,000 pertaining to the deceased or her widow.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Mr. Lewis, there's been some discussion about bad faith claims and Stowers. Has this court ever recognized cause of action for bad faith claim in a third-party claim against an insurance company?
I believe they're trying to make
an unreasonable failure to settle within the time limit to demand an essentially a Stowers claim right now.
So what's present in this case is the Stowers claim.
Well, they made a demand. It's not present yet. They made a demand that reflects a $2.7 million demand. They've increased their demand from $40,000 to $2.7 million based on the fact that there was a receipt of the check on April 23rd.
But if it's a Stowers claim and the insurance company was negligent in the handling of the claim, then the damages potentially would be whatever was the judgment against Padilla, irrespective of the policy limits.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we have a death claim here and some severe injury claims, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But the posture of this case at this point is the Stowers claim, and that's how this comes to us here.
Actually, we are at the underlying suit stage at this point, and yes, they are now attempting to create a Stowers claim, but time is not and was never vested. There was a tender of the policy limits 4 months earlier before they ever made their April 10th demand. And the respondents do not now contend that they were injured in any way by receiving the checks 1 week later.
Does the party have the right to impose a time limit as a material provision of an offer?
They have a right to impose a time limit. But the Sidereus case said that even when a time for performance is stated, merely stipulating a time for performance does not make time of essence or a material term of the contract. If it truly was a material term of the contract, they would have gladly accepted the tender of the $40,000 4 months earlier when it was made.
Why was the request made on April the 30th to extend the deadline?
That was made merely to formalize the agreement, Your Honor. Merely formalize the agreement because there had been conversations between them before then when a repudiation was made. And in order to resolve the matter out of courtesy, an extension request was made and an agreement was sent over to make it a formalized document. But as the Cochran decision and the Borden decision state, the Rule 11 agreement to be enforceable does not have to be a formal document. It can be enforced as letters between counsel. And they have accepted the terms of the settlement in the April 23rd, 1991 letter.
Do we have to overrule or disapprove of former writings of this court to adopt your position?
No formal rulings of this court
regarding the
at
agreement.
All.
The agreement must be in effect at the time the court renders the judgment.
No, Your Honor, and that's where the confusion arises regarding consent judgments. As Mr. Olivier agreed, the only cases which in any way he even claims support his position are the consent judgment cases. This case does not involve the attempt to enter a consent judgment without consent.
The Kennedy case cites those cases without making the distinction you're making just today. Right?
Yes, Your Honor, but the Quintero case, as well as the Berneman case, both make that distinction. They state that their reversal of a consent judgment entered without consent was not without prejudice for the court for the party to plead and prove an enforceable settlement agreement under Rule 11. Both the Berneman case and the Quintero case support that position and make that distinction. Now, in this time of public skepticism over the legal profession, are we prepared to tell the public that while they should honor all of their written agreements, we as officers of the court can renege on our own written agreements as long as we do so before the agreement is filed with the court? This is a lawsuit to enforce a valid Rule 11 agreement.
Any other questions?
The court reverse and render in accordance with its former decision.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the oral arguments and all of today's causes. They are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
Yeah,